and halls, keeping watch on the lawbreakers behind bars. The majority of those locked away were typical sheep-stealing ogres, kidnapping witches, and man-eating animals that had been caught before they fled into the dwarf forests. The prison was also the home of a great mystery. During the 100-year sleeping curse the Eastern Kingdom had endured, the prison had been the only place in the kingdom that had been spared. All the soldiers and inmates inside had strangely remained conscious while the rest of the country had slumbered. More recently, the mystery had developed when the prison also became the only place in the kingdom not covered in the Enchantress's demonic thorn bushes and vines. Whether it was a fluke or a miracle was the question. Many assumed the prison was just too far removed to be affected by the curses. However, unbeknownst to all the soldiers and inmates inside, the prison's exclusion from the kingdom's greatest woes was due to a high-profile prisoner who resided on the 13th floor. Rumpelstiltskin was serving his 127th year behind bars. He was a very small man with large baggy eyes, a button nose, and short hair that clung to his head like a helmet. He wore a large collared shirt, tight pants on his tiny legs, and pointed red shoes that jingled when he walked. After his infamous failed attempt to take the firstborn child of the Eastern Kingdom's former queen, Rumpelstiltskin went into hiding. But after a few years of being at large, the small man couldn't live with the guilt of what he had almost done. So 127 years ago, he decided to turn himself in and had lived at Pinocchio Prison ever since. Rumpelstiltskin had a tiny chamber all to himself. He had two barred windows, one on the heavy door of his cell and another on the wall facing Mermaid Bay. Both were too high for him to see out of unless he jumped, so the dark stones of his chamber floor and walls were all he had to look at every day. His life had simplified greatly while in prison. He slept on a large stack of hay in the corner and ate on a tiny table pushed to the side with only one spoon and bowl in his possession. Although Rumpelstiltskin had many magical capabilities, he had decided to give them up when he went to prison, fearing magic would only lead him to trouble. He kept his quarters as simple as possible. The first decade or so of imprisonment was incredibly lonely for the little man, but luckily for him, an unexpected roommate eventually moved in. One day, a strong ocean breeze blew a seed into his chamber, and a week later, a small daisy began to grow in between two rocks of the stone floor. Rumpelstiltskin was amazed such a thing could happen. How could something so pleasant grow in such a miserable place? Of all the locations in the world, why did it decide to land here? He pondered the question for a great while, glad of something to distract him from his solitude and shame. He ultimately decided the flower must have needed a friend as much as he did, and that its presence in his cell had been purposeful. He took great care of the flower, impressively keeping it alive the entire time he had been in the prison. He shared his water with the daisy, he told it stories, and when it fell ill, he would stand on his tiptoes by the window with his spoon and reflect sunlight toward it until it regained its strength. To the average person, having a flower as a companion may have seemed a little odd, but for Rumpelstiltskin, it was the best friend he had ever had. The flower never mocked him for the clothes he wore, like others had in his past. The flower never judged him for wanting the most out of life. The flower never used him for political gain. The flower never condemned him for the mistakes he made years before. The flower was only capable of doing one thing, sharing its beauty. In a way, life in prison had been the best thing that ever happened to Rumpelstiltskin, giving him the most meaningful relationship he had ever had. However, his self-surrender hadn't only been a way for him to clear his conscience. It was also a way for him to protect himself from alliances he had made in his past. And unfortunately, after he'd spent so long hiding from his past eventually found him. It was just before sunset when a thunderous noise was heard outside the prison. It was an intense combination of snapping and crunching and popping that became louder and louder by the second. The prison began to shake. His bowl and spoon rattled on his table. Whatever it was getting closer. Rumpelstiltskin jumped up and down at his window, trying to see what was causing the commotion. What he saw was the most terrifying sight he had seen in years. Like an enormous earthy stampede, a tsunami of angry thorn bushes and vines traveled across the land, growing in the prison's direction. "Oh, no!" Rumpelstiltskin gasped. He clasped his hands around his mouth and looked around his cell. There was only one person capable of such magic, and after 127 years, he knew she had finally come for him. The wooden soldiers rushed through the halls in a panic. "Thorn bushes and vines are headed for the prison!" one shouted. "Prepare for an attack!" another yelled. Rumpelstiltskin looked down at the daisy. It was quivering.
There, there, little flower,
he said, and gently stroked one of its leaves.
Everything is going to be all right. I'm going to hide you.
He quickly retrieved his bowl off the table and covered his friend with it. The prison was hit by the plants, and the impact made the whole fortress sway. The thorn bushes and vines crawled up the sides of the structure, wrapping around it like an army of serpents, until all the windows were covered and the prison went dim inside. After a few quiet moments, a series of soft rumbles pulsed through the prison like a giant heartbeat. Each rumble was stronger than the next and came from several floors below Rumpelstiltskin's cell. Something was slowly making its way higher and higher through the prison. Rumpelstiltskin could hear all the wooden soldiers from above rushing down to fight off whatever was intruding below. The clanking of their weapons echoed as they tried fighting it off. They were definitely fighting off more than just plants. Finally, Rumpelstiltskin heard the battle reach the 13th floor. He was too scared to move. He smelled things burning, and smoke started to flow into his cell from under his cell door. Each soldier's scream was followed by a loud thud as their wooden bodies hit the floor one by one. Once all the soldiers were gone, a pair of soft footsteps came down the hall and stopped at Rumpelstiltskin's cell door. He was trembling, afraid these were his last moments alive. A bright flash of violet light blasted the cell door into smithereens. Rumpelstiltskin braced himself as he was pelted by its debris. Once the smoke from the blast cleared, he finally saw who had been causing all the chaos. Standing in the doorway of his cell was a tall and beautiful woman. She had long magenta hair that floated and rippled above her like slow-moving flames. Her eyes were violet, with long feathered eyelashes like a moth's antenna. She wore a long purple gown with matching gloves and a high collar. A ghostly cape flowed around her and through the hall like a thick sheet of smoke.
Esmia,
Rumpelstiltskin said in horror. The enchantress's bright red lips curved into a smirk.
Hello, Rumpy, Esmia said in her playful, airy voice. How I've missed you.
Esmia stepped into Rumpelstiltskin's cell and examined the small chamber. Vines and thorn bushes followed her, growing around the walls of the cell, covering the inside of the prison as she traveled through it.
I love what you've done with the place,
Esmia said sarcastically, passing the stack of hay he used as a bed.
It doesn't fit a man of your exquisite taste, though, does it? I can't imagine why you'd abandon me to spend 13 decades in here.
Rumpelstiltskin remained very still, knowing it wasn't wise to make sudden movements around dangerous creatures.
Have you come to kill me?
He said, with a quivering jaw. The enchantress forced out a theatrical laugh that did little to comfort him.
Why would I want to kill my oldest friend?
She said with a menacing smile.
Besides, if I wanted you dead, I would have killed you ages ago.
Her smile faded and her violet eyes glared down at him.
Why else do you think I've spared you from all the curses I've cast over the kingdom so far?
Rumpelstiltskin had always wondered if the exceptions were because of him.
If you aren't going to kill me, then what brings you here?
He asked, trembling even more. He was convinced she must have a fate worse than death planned for him.
Look at you, Rumpy. You're just as helpless as the day I found you,
Esmia said pityingly.
When we met, you were just another miserable dwarf working in the mines. But I knew you and I were kindred spirits. We both wanted more than the world was offering us, and we both were ostracized because of it. I never meant to anger you,
Rumpelstiltskin said, and lowered his head.
I had to turn myself in. I couldn't live with what I had done. Or what you failed to do, that is,
Esmia said.
But all is forgiven.
Rumpelstiltskin knew her too well to believe her. Esmia had something up her sleeve. She always did.
What do you want from me?
He asked. Esmia went to the window. The vines and thorn bushes covering the outside parted so she could see the view of the bay.
Like it or not, we made a deal, she said. I've come back so you can finally fulfill your end of the bargain. I saved you from a melancholy life in the mines. I made you my apprentice and taught you magic. And all I ever asked in exchange was for your assistance. You never said I would have to kidnap a child,
Rumpelstiltskin said,
and a princess, no less. I made it incredibly easy for you,
Esmia said sharply, her tone growing angry.
I bewitched the king into thinking he needed a wife who could spin hay into gold. I chose the village girl he ordered to do so. I planned the whole negotiation between the two of you. All you had to do was take the child that was owed to you. You wanted me to do your dirty work,
Rumpelstiltskin peeped.
You wanted my name to be tarnished if anything went wrong, Of course I did, she said unapologetically. I was still in the Happily Ever After Assembly at the time. I couldn't get caught stealing an infant princess. As far as the fairies knew, I was still one of them. As far as I knew, you were still one of them too, Rumpelstiltskin said. I thought I was going to be the apprentice of a great fairy, not an enchantress who is secretly plotting to take over the world.
Esmia took delight in remembering the deception.
Yes, everyone was surprised, she said. Of course, that all changed when the rest of the fairies found out you were working for me, and I wasn't invited to the child's christening. I lost my temper and cursed the whole kingdom to die.
They would have, too, if the fairy godmother hadn't converted my curse into a pathetic sleeping curse. The enchantress closed her eyes and massaged the side of her head. And since then, Sleeping Beauty has been my own personal nightmare, she said. You should have seen her face when I attacked her in the forest, though. There she was, the martyr queen, trembling with fear. It was priceless. Esmia smiled to herself and let out a chuckle.
You wanted me to kidnap her when she was a baby. Then you cursed her for 100 years, and now you've covered her kingdom in vines and thorns, Rumpelstiltskin said. Why do you hate Queen Sleeping Beauty so much?
Esmia glanced at him sideways as she contemplated her honest answer and the answer she would give him. Whatever she said, there's always much more she wasn't saying.
That's where everyone gets it wrong, Esmia said. I'll admit I take great satisfaction in seeing the Eastern Kingdom in a state of turmoil. My reputation was bruised when my fatal spell was reduced into an extensive nap, so there is an element of revenge I take great pleasure in. But the reason I've attacked the Eastern Kingdom again has nothing to do with Queen Sleeping Beauty. Then why are you causing all this chaos? Rumpelstiltskin asked, nervously looking at the vines and thorn bushes outside.
Everything has its purpose, Esmia said, with a proud and sinister gleam in her eyes.
It's been so long since my last public appearance. The world thought I was dead. I needed to show them that I was back and more powerful than ever. And when better than on a day they were celebrating the end of my last curse? It's deliciously evil of me, isn't it?
Esmia closed her eyes, and a wide smile grew on her face.
What part of our bargain do you want me to fulfill? Rumpelstiltskin asked. Surely you don't want me to kidnap Queen Sleeping Beauty now.
It was never Sleeping Beauty that I was after, Esmia said, and angrily paced around the chamber.
Sleeping Beauty this, Sleeping Beauty that. She wouldn't even have that ridiculous name if it weren't for me.
This puzzled Rumpelstiltskin even more.
Then what were you after? He asked. I was after a child, Esmia confessed. A child of royal blood, specifically. It's one of the many things I need to complete a special project I've been working on.
A special project? He asked.
You mean taking over the world, I assume. That's what you've always wanted, isn't it?
Esmia looked him straight in the eyes.
Something like that, she said. And it's a lot harder than it looks. Shortly before I met you, I figured out a way to do it. It's an enchantment of sorts. It's a very complex formula that requires certain properties to be claimed and special assets to obtain. Once I manage to gather all of them together, not even the fairy godmother herself can stop me.
It's been more than a century since I last saw you, Rumpelstiltskin said. Why have you decided to strike now after all this time? Esmia waved a hand, and the stones in the floor rose to form a large chair.
You haven't been around, Rumby, Esmia said, and took a seat. While you've been locked away, I have had quite the century. It's not as if I've been lying around this whole time. I've been betrayed, I've been poisoned, and I've come back from the verge of death stronger and more powerful than ever.
Poisoned? Rumpelstiltskin asked. By whom?
Evely.
Esmia said the name as if it were a disease.
Evely?
Rumpelstiltskin asked.
Who is that?
She was supposed to be my solution, Esmia said. However, she ended up being my greatest disappointment. She waved her hand again, and the stones in the floor formed a stool for Rumpelstiltskin to sit on.
It's a long story, so have a seat, Esmia ordered.
Rumpelstiltskin didn't argue.
After I cursed the Eastern Kingdom, I went into hiding, Esmia explained. I may have been the most powerful fairy in the world, but I was no match for all the other fairies put together. I knew I couldn't strike again until I was further along with my project, until I was past the point of no return. So I plotted in secret, keeping a watchful eye on all the kingdoms for the pieces I needed to continue my work. I assembled a quaint little castle in the northeast where no one could find me, and plotted out what my next move would be. But it required so many elements outside my reach. I knew I would have to be patient. I brought many troubled souls into the castle, hoping to produce a proper apprentice. But they all failed me, each being a bigger disappointment than the last. Many years later, in the Charming Kingdom, when the late King Chester was just a prince, the palace had an unexpected visitor one night. A young maiden banged on the palace doors, seeking shelter from a horrible rainstorm. Chester instantly fell in love with her, and asked his parents for permission to propose. Being the old-fashioned king and queen they were, Chester's parents said he could only marry the maiden if he could prove she was of royal blood. So the prince devised a plan to test the maiden's royal status. He made her a bed in the guest chambers with a stack of a dozen mattresses and placed a pea under the very bottom, convincing his parents that only a royal could feel the imperfection through the mattresses. The next morning, the maiden complained about a restless night, and Chester was certain he had found his future wife. He asked for the maiden's hand in marriage, but she refused his proposal. The maiden had a secret. She had tossed and turned with discomfort all night because she was pregnant, not because she was a princess. The maiden had been a simple peasant runaway, embarrassed to be with child out of wedlock. She disappeared from the palace as quickly as she came, and Prince Chester never saw her again. Naturally, when I heard about the so-called pregnant princess on the run, I was intrigued, knowing I needed a royal child. I tracked her down in the forest, where she was living on her own in a cave. To my delight, she was very much with child when I discovered her. I made her an offer she couldn't refuse. In exchange for her child, I would give her a life of riches and luxury beyond her wildest dreams, the usual. She agreed and the deal was made. Unfortunately, she backed out of our agreement shortly before giving birth to the child. She ran into a neighboring village and died giving birth to a little girl, whom the villagers named Evely. I soon discovered that the maiden hadn't been royal, and Evely couldn't be the child I needed. I let the villagers raise her, while I conceived another plan to get use out of Evely after all. I was going to train her to seduce and marry Prince White of the Northern Kingdom. Together, they would produce an heir, and I would finally have a child of royal blood that I desired. Unfortunately, when I returned for Evely in her adolescence, she had fallen madly in love with one of the village boys, a pathetic aspiring poet by the name of Mira. I took Evely to my castle in the northeast to begin training, but all she did was cry and whine every day and night about how much she missed Mira. So I brought the boy to her, imprisoning him inside a magic mirror. I thought it had been a kind gesture on my part, but it only caused Evely to grow more spiteful. She conducted a plan of her own against me. She broke into my room of potions and concocted a poison so strong that when a few drops touched the ground outside her window, all the trees and plants for miles around were killed. Evely laced a small dagger with the poison and stabbed me with it. The poison almost killed me. I shriveled down to the state of a dying human. I lost all my power, all my beauty, and all hope that I would fulfill my plans for the future. I ran as far away as I could, fearing Evely would try to finish me off. But the stupid girl was so consumed with trying to free Mira, she forgot all about me. An old witch named Hagatha found me in the woods, barely alive. She recognized me and the effects of the poison. She brought me to her small hut in the dwarf forest and nursed me back to health. I became her apprentice, but she treated me horribly, taking advantage of the person I once was. She sent me out on the most gruesome errands and forced me to sleep outside like an animal. Ironically, the poison is also what saved me. The Happily Ever After Assembly had been looking for me since I cursed the Eastern Kingdom. They didn't recognize me in my frail state and decided I was dead. But one day, a few decades later, Hagatha and I were collecting plants from the thornbush pit that she planted around her hut. She was forcing me to do all the work, and my hands were scraped and scratched from all the thorns. I remember feeling more angry than I'd ever felt in my life. I was furious that I, the woman who had once been more powerful than anyone else, had become a witch's slave. And with this anger, I felt something different. Suddenly, I felt alive again, like a candle had been relit inside of me. After many long years, my body had finally recovered from the effects of the poison, and my powers had come back. It's true what they say. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I am living proof. I was more powerful than ever before. My powers were different, too. My magic had always come from a happily ever after source, coming from a life among fairies. That's why every curse I created could be broken with a kiss or token of affection. But not anymore. This time, my magic had no limits. I pushed Hagatha into the pit and cursed the vines and thorn bushes to trap anything that came close to it, Esmia confessed.
You pushed her into the thorn bush pit?
Rumpelstiltskin asked.
All this time, that's been your magic festering in that godless place?
Indeed, the enchantress said with a boastful shrug. Believe me, I wanted to take the credit for it, but I still had work to do before I went public again. I returned to the castle and collected all my belongings, ready to complete what I had started so long ago. But I knew that I would have to continue being patient. The kingdoms were experiencing a golden age. Cinderella and Prince Charming were married. Sleeping Beauty had just awoken. Snow White was crowned queen. I knew if I waited until the right moment, my return would have a much bigger impact. And now it has.
Rumpelstiltskin feared what her newfound strength would mean for the future of the kingdoms.
I've never understood you, he said. You used to be so admired and loved by the whole world. Why wasn't that enough? When did it all go wrong?
The enchantress looked at the floor with a snide expression. People only love you as long as they're getting something out of you. But the minute you say something they don't want to hear, or do something they don't want to see, all the admiration drains from their hearts.
But why this obsession with power?
Rumpelstiltskin asked, as cautiously as possible.
Why do you need the world, Esmia?
Esmia let out a long sigh. I have my reasons, she said sharply. And quite frankly, I don't give a damn if you or anyone else understands. Attention grew in the room, but it wasn't between Esmia and Rumpelstiltskin. It was between Esmia and the world.
But where do I fit in? Rumpelstiltskin asked. If you're so powerful now, why do you need me?
Well, that's simple, Esmia said. Out of all my apprentices over the years, you have been the most loyal to me, Rumpy. You actually started what I asked of you, and now I'm going to let you finish it. Besides, it'll be nice to have a friend around once I take over.
They exchanged a weighty glance, both aware that this was nothing close to a friendship.
There is another child, isn't there?
Rumpelstiltskin asked, with a heavy heart, already knowing the answer.
You want me to kidnap another child?
Precisely, the enchantress said. Rumpelstiltskin lowered his head and closed his eyes. He knew he wouldn't have a choice this time. Refusal would mean death.
Well, that's enough catching up for one day,
Esmia said, and glided toward the door with a newfound spring in her step.
Come along, Rumpy. There's much work to be done. I've waited almost 2 centuries for this, so as you can imagine, I've grown very impatient.
The stone sank back into the ground, and Rumpelstiltskin fell on his behind.
Where are we going?
He asked.
Hagatha's old hut,
the enchantress said.
It's where I've been spending most of my time since my castle was destroyed a year ago. You should see what I've done with the place. A little magic goes a long way in the dwarf forests.
Rumpelstiltskin nostalgically looked around at his tiny cell. It had never seemed so much like home until he was being forced to leave it.
I just have to say goodbye,
Rumpelstiltskin said sadly. Esmia raised an eyebrow, not knowing who on earth he was talking about. Perhaps prison had been harder on her small friend than she'd imagined. Rumpelstiltskin got on the floor and took the bowl off the daisy.
I have to go now, he said, fighting back tears. Please don't look at me like that. You'll be all right.
He lightly stroked one of its white petals.
Goodbye, little flower. Please take care of yourself.
Rumpelstiltskin stood and walked through the doorway, leaving his cell for the first time in 127 years, but stepping into a world of even harsher imprisonment. Esmia lingered in the doorway, glaring down at the flower. She couldn't believe something so small and inferior could be so important, so protected, or so loved. It ignited a fire inside of her. The enchantress waved a hand in its direction, and the daisy withered away, crumbling into bits of nothing. A smile appeared on her face, so satisfied to destroy something even so small.
Chapter 11. The Queen and the Frog. It was the final moments before dawn, and the stars were slowly fading away as the sky began to brighten. Froggy and the twins had been traveling through the dwarf forest for the majority of the night, covering ground as quickly and quietly as possible. Even after all they had been through together, the twins had never seen Froggy so tense. He constantly watched the path ahead and glanced behind them every few steps to make sure they weren't being followed.
You seem stressed, dude, Connor said, looking up at his green friend.
These times are definitely worthy of concern, Froggy said. By the way, what's a dude?
Connor shrugged. It's lingo from our world. Nothing important, he said. Sorry, I forgot where I was for a second.
Alex moved closer to Froggy as they walked, keen to have a more serious conversation. How bad is it really? She asked. We've only heard from those animals in the forest and Mother Goose. What's your take on it?
Froggy sighed.
I can't recall a time that's been so troubling, he said. Even when the Evil Queen was at large, people went on with their lives. Now that the Enchantress is back, it's as if the world has stopped. Everyone stays indoors, too afraid to come outside until the Happily Ever After Assembly can do something.
And have they done anything? Connor asked. Have they figured out any way to stop her?
I'm afraid not, Froggy said. They tried unenchanting the plants covering the Eastern Kingdom, but it was no use. The magic is too strong. Esme has grown more powerful than anyone ever thought possible.
Besides covering the Eastern Kingdom in plants, has the Enchantress attacked anything else? Alex asked.
That's all for now, Froggy said.
Which means she's likely to strike again at any moment.
Why is everyone calling it the Eastern Kingdom now? Connor asked. Did I miss something? What happened to the Sleeping Kingdom?
Because the kingdom had finally been restored to its former glory before the sleeping curse, Froggy explained. Queen Sleeping Beauty wanted to celebrate the kingdom's restoration by reclaiming its former title. They were having a huge celebration on the night the Enchantress attacked. Those poor people, they weren't even expecting it.
I wonder if my rubber band trick helped, Connor said to himself.
Why has Esmea covered the kingdom in plants of all things? Alex asked. If the Happily Ever After Assembly can't stop her magic anymore, why not curse Sleeping Beauty to die again?
Like everyone else in the fairy tale world, Froggy could only guess.
The symbolism, I'm assuming, Froggy said, and rubbed his tired eyes. During the sleeping curse, the entire kingdom was covered in thorn bushes and vines because no one was taking care of the grounds. I'm sure Esmea is taking pleasure in seeing all the hard work go to waste by covering it again. She's getting more use out of hostages and casualties. Making people suffer is crueler than killing them, if you ask me.
Alex and Connor were a tiny bit relieved to hear this. If hostages were what the Enchantress was collecting, then maybe their mom's life wasn't in jeopardy. They just hoped she wasn't suffering.
And now the plants are keeping people prisoner there, just like in the Thornbush Pit, Alex said to herself, trying to make sense of it all.
Exactly, Froggy said. Although, no one has been able to make a connection between the two.
What about Queen Sleeping Beauty and King Chase? Are they all right? Alex asked.
King Chase is still stuck in the Eastern Kingdom, as far as anyone knows, Froggy said. Queen Sleeping Beauty barely made it out. She was attacked while making a run for the border. All of her soldiers were killed, but she survived, thankfully.
Soldiers from the Charming Kingdom found her in the forest and brought her back to the Charming Palace.
That's horrible, Alex said with a sigh. Even though she took our mom, after what we learned about the Evil Queen, I'm trying to come up with a reason the Enchantress just may be misunderstood, too. But it's difficult.
Connor grunted.
Not for me, he said. I don't care what her excuse is. If she hurts Mom in any way, I'll make sure it's the last thing she does.
The sun started to rise, and the land around them became more visible. In the distance, the twins were taken back to see a familiar wall made of gray brick that stretched across the entire horizon.
Isn't that the wall surrounding the Red Riding Hood Kingdom? Alex asked.
Oh, yeah, Connor said, recognizing it too.
Wait, why are we headed there? I thought you were taking us back to your place, Froggy.
I am, Froggy reassured.
What happened to your hole in the ground? Connor asked.
I moved, Froggy said. I live in the castle now, with Queen Red.
Froggy blushed a shade of dark green and went silent. Alex and Connor looked at each other with, "Did you just hear that?" written on their faces. Froggy walked ahead of them, crossing through the western gate of the Red Riding Hood Kingdom's famous wall.
"Good morning, fellas," Froggy said with a nod to the guards monitoring the gate.
"Morning, sir,"
they said back, bowing slightly as he walked past them. The twins ran through the gate and caught up with Froggy on the other side.
"Wait a minute," Connor said with a laugh. "You're living with Red? Are you guys like a couple or something?"
Froggy turned even darker green.
"Well, I suppose so," he said, too bashful to look them in the eye.
"I wasn't expecting that," Alex said with raised eyebrows.
"How the heck did that happen?" Connor asked, with a confused grin on his face. "I mean, you're so worldly and she's so... not."
"Connor, don't be rude,"
Alex said, and nudged him.
No, it's quite all right, Froggy said. It's very simple how it all happened. Shortly after I was transformed back into a human by your grandmother, and her castle was rebuilt from the fire, Queen Red invited me over for some tea one afternoon. She wanted to thank me again for saving her life during the battle against the evil queen and the big bad wolf pack. It was only supposed to last an hour or so, but we ended up talking all day. Well, she talked, I listened. But we really connected, and since then, our friendship has taken a more romantic turn.
Their mouths hung wide open, not helping Froggy in the slightest.
And how does she feel about you being in your frog form again? Alex asked. It was challenging at first. She was afraid to touch me and wouldn't let me sit on the furniture, but she's come a long way and knows it's for the greater good, even if it does put a pause in our relationship for now, Froggy said. Red's really an exceptional woman. You just have to get to know her.
Is she still hung up on Jack? Connor asked. Alex gave him a dirty look.
The dark green coloring faded from Froggy's face.
We're working on that, he said. I don't think anyone can ever stop loving someone entirely. Sometimes love turns to hate, but I'm not sure it's possible to ever stop feeling for them. Despite whatever feelings she has left over for Jack, I have no doubts about her affection toward me.
Froggy smiled and nodded to himself. Alex and Connor shrugged to each other. Relationships always seem complicated to them, but they seemed almost impossible to understand under these circumstances.
Does it bother you, though? Alex asked, knowing how much she cared about someone else in the past.
Froggy shook his head confidently.
I figure if Red is willing to accept me, flawed and frogged, then I can do the same for her, regardless of what baggage she brings, he said. And in time, the longer Jack and Goldilocks are out of the picture, the better it will be for her. Out of sight, out of mind.
Uh-huh, Connor said with a snort, looking at him through the corner of his eye. Whatever happened to Jack and Goldilocks? Has anyone heard from them?
Very little, actually, Froggy said.
Occasionally, they'll be spotted on the outskirts of the kingdom, and a villager will alert the castle guards, but they've kept pretty quiet, and for my and Red's sake, I'm not complaining. The twins were happy to hear Jack and Goldilocks were still together and on the run, relieved that at least something had stayed constant while the rest of the world was in chaos. They walked through the hills of Bo Peep Family Farms and soon reached the picturesque town in the center of the kingdom. The twins were delighted to see all the dainty cottage homes and brick buildings with pointed hay roofs again. They smiled at seeing Henny Penny Bank, the Shoe Inn, and shops like Patty Cake Bakery and Jack Horner's Pie Shop, all exactly the same as their last visit. One thing was visibly different. The town that had once been full of farmers and shepherds hauling their livestock around was deserted.
It's so empty, Alex said.
Remember how crowded the town was last time? Connor said. It was like take your goat to work day or something, if I remember correctly.
Froggy let out a sad sigh. It's a sign of the times, I'm afraid, he said. It's like this in all the villages and all the kingdoms. No one leaves their home unless it's absolutely necessary.
They walked through the park in the center of the town and were pleased to see the Humpty Dumpty and the Little Boy Who Cried Wolf memorials and Jack and Jill Hill. The twins couldn't help but look at them a little differently, though, considering the information they had learned from Mother Goose.
Whoa, Connor said, looking across the park. Check out the renovation.
At the edge of the park, facing the twins, was Red Riding Hood's castle, her new castle. It stood twice as tall and sat twice as wide as the previous one. It had several towers, each higher than the next, a large dome in the center, and a gigantic clock just above the newly built front steps. Alex and Connor both tilted their heads and squinted at the new castle. There was something rather peculiar about it.
Looks familiar, Alex said.
Sure does, Connor said. It almost looks like all the other castles and palaces mixed together, doesn't it?
Just wait until you see the inside, Froggy said. Red built me my very own library. It's just splendid. Hundreds and hundreds of books, and they're all mine.
That's wonderful, Alex said, sharing his enthusiastic smile.
Don't worry, Froggy said. I kept all the books you gave me. They have their own special section.
He winked at her, and Alex grinned. She remembered the books they had bonded over the first time they met. The trio made their way up the castle's front steps, and two guards opened the impressively large red doors for them to enter.
Good morning, sir.
The guard said to Froggy, and bowed like the previous set of guards had.
Morning, gentlemen, Froggy said.
Does every guard know you or something? Connor asked him.
Well, I'm not exactly easy to forget, Froggy said. I don't fit in around here, looking like this. I'm just glad the villagers stop fainting when they see me. Most of them, at least.
They took their first steps into the castle, and the twins gasped. There was a marble floor under their feet, golden pillars to their sides, and an enormous grand staircase in front of them. And to no one's surprise, every wall was covered in a portrait of Queen Red in different glamorized positions.
She certainly spared no expense, Connor said, eyeing everything around him.
He looked down at the floor and noticed tiny basket-shaped tiles connected the corners of the marble tiles.
It sort of reminds me of Cinderella's ballroom, Alex said, except redified.
A short and plump handmaiden was descending the stairs with an empty tea tray. Her cheeks were pink, and she was wheezing from the effort. Alex and Connor hid behind Froggy, remembering their last encounter with her hadn't been a pleasant one.
"Welcome back, Prince Charlie," the handmaiden called out to Froggy. It was strange for the twins to hear him addressed by his real name.
"The Queen is in the library. I just served her some breakfast."
"Thank you. I'm headed there now," he called back to her.
"Would you like me to bring you up some lily pad tea?"
"That would be wonderful, thank you. 3 flies in mine, please. Would you like any tea, Alex, Connor?"
"Sure, what the heck," Connor said. "It wouldn't be a visit without some lily pad tea."
The twins followed Froggy up the stairs, passing the handmaiden, who stopped in her tracks and stared at them peculiarly, not being able to recall exactly where she knew them from, but clearly remembering it hadn't been a good experience. They reached the top of the stairs, made a right, and traveled down another impeccably decorated hallway, also lined with portraits of Queen Red. They found a pair of golden doors with "Library, Place of Books," carved into the wall above it. Connor pointed out the carving to his sister.
"I bet you anything it's so she doesn't forget what's inside," he quickly snickered into her ear.
"Here we are," Froggy said, and pushed open the doors.
The twins stepped inside and were awestruck once again. It was the most elegant library they'd ever seen, beating even the one in Snow White's palace. Alex almost teared up. Connor nodded with raised eyebrows.
"It's beautiful," Alex said, and placed a hand over her heart.
"Not bad," Connor said.
Shelves stretched the tops of the very high ceiling, with ladders and balconies on various levels. A group of armchairs and sofas was placed in the center of the room, near a large fireplace with a gigantic wolfskin rug that had once been the Big Bad Wolf himself, spread across the floor in front of it. A beautiful chandelier hung in the center of the room, giving an abundance of light perfect for reading. There were many portraits of Queen Red hung around the library, but an especially large painting was hung over the fireplace of Red reading a book in one of the armchairs. The twins had to do a double take, because just below the portrait was the real Queen Red Riding Hood, seated in an armchair reading a book in the identical position as the portrait. She looked up as soon as she heard the doors open.
"You're back!"
Red said when she saw Froggy. She tossed aside the book, which was thin and mostly pictures, and ran to her bow. They collided into a giant embrace. Queen Red Riding Hood was a beautiful young woman with blonde hair and bright blue eyes. She was always dressed to the nines in red gowns and a hooded cape. But the twins noticed something different about Red. She wasn't wearing nearly as much makeup or jewelry as she had been before. Perhaps her relationship with Froggy had simplified the young queen's need to impress. Froggy tried kissing her, but Red pulled away.
"No kisses, remember?" Red said. "I love you to death, darling, but I just find you repulsive at the moment. There's nothing worse than a cold and clammy kiss. You two!"
Red's full attention was diverted to the twins when she spotted them. She stared at them as if Froggy had brought a poisonous snake into the castle.
"Red, do you remember Alex and Connor?" Froggy asked.
"Remember? How could I forget?"
Red said, not looking away from them.
"Hi, Red,"
Alex said politely.
"How's it going?"
Connor said nicely.
"Forgive me. I don't mean to be rude," Red said to the twins. "It's just every time I see you two, I'm heartbroken, kidnapped, or homeless."
The twins couldn't argue. She was right. "No worries," Connor said. Red eyed them nervously for a minute before saying anything else.
"So, what brings you back to this world?" she asked. "Vacation? Visiting your grandmother?"
"Not exactly," Alex said.
"We were lost in the woods," Connor said. "Surprise, surprise."
"Thank goodness we saw Froggy in the forest. Otherwise, who knows where we would have ended up," Alex added.
Red glanced back and forth between them and then to Froggy.
"So you brought them here?" she said through a forced smile. "Lovely!"
"They had nowhere else to go," Froggy said. "I couldn't let them wander around alone at a time like this."
Red looked back at the twins, still anxious.
"No, I suppose not," she said.
The twins tried to break the awkward tension.
"Your new castle's beautiful," Alex said.
"I feel so at home. At many homes, actually," Connor said. "Was there a theme you were going for?"
"Inspiration, mostly,"
Red said blankly.
"Ah," Connor said. "Well, it certainly feels inspired."
The handmaiden knocked on the door and entered the library carrying tea for Froggy and the twins.
Oh, wonderful. Why don't we catch up over some tea?
Red said. Her tone didn't match her enthusiastic words. The handmaiden set the tea tray down on a table by the armchairs and left the room. The twins took a seat across from Froggy and Red, and the impromptu tea party began. Froggy held Red's hand lovingly.
Is this all right?
Froggy asked her.
Of course it is. I'm wearing gloves, Red said.
It was silent for a couple moments, with only the sounds of their spoons clanking against their teacups, filling the awkward tension in the room.
So, how old are you two now?
Red asked.
You look like you've grown.
We're 13, Connor said.
Oh, that's nice, Red said. That's how old I was when I was elected queen. Of course, I had my granny to help me.
How is your granny? Alex asked.
Retired, actually, Red said. She lives the shoe-in now, so I've taken over all responsibilities as queen.
How's queenship treating you? Connor asked. He sipped his lily pad tea and then spit it out immediately.
It's been difficult, Red said. There's much more to being queen than people realize. It's not all about jewels and fabulous dresses and an abundance of affection. There are lots of decisions to be made every day about peasants and farmers and their needs and whatnot. Luckily, I've had Charlie to help me.
That's nice, Alex said. Have you passed any new laws or anything worth mentioning recently? Red looked up at the ceiling, trying to recall what her latest act as queen had been.
I raised taxes,
she said happily, but then her smile faded into a frown.
But the people didn't like that at all, so I quickly lowered them. My mistake, didn't realize they would take it so personally. Apparently, my kingdom has a strong ecology, so there's no need to anyway.
A strong economy, dear, Froggy corrected her.
Oh, yes, economy. Forgive me, Red said. We grow so much food and produce so much wool that our trades are very strong with the other kingdoms. The Red Riding Hood Kingdom is the breadbasket of this world, no pun intended.
The twins politely nodded along, but were in shock someone like Red was still allowed to lead a kingdom. Froggy decided to save the twins from the conversation and escorted them to the corner of the room.
I want to show you something special,
Froggy said, and pointed to a special shelf where all of Alex's old books were kept.
Here's where I keep all of your books, Alex.
They look very happy there, she said with a smile. Her eyes fell on the tiles of the books just below them.
Around the world in 80 days? 20,000 leagues under the sea? Frankenstein?
She discovered with delight.
Froggy, these are all the classics from our world. Where did you get all of them?
Your grandmother, actually,
Froggy said.
She wanted to thank me again for helping you the last time you were here.
I must say, the people in your world definitely know how to tell stories.
Alex smiled at the thought, knowing most of the authors of her world had been inspired by the stories of his world.
I've read a few myself, Red said, trying to stay relevant in the room. What's that heavy one that I enjoy so much, Charlie? With that funny little language, The Complete Works of Shakeyfruit, was it?
The Complete Works of Shakespeare, my dear, Froggy corrected her.
Oh, yes, that's the one, Red said. It was a lovely read. One story is so pleasant, and then the next is so tragic. Took me nearly a year to get through them all. I hope he's still writing in your world. He has a lot of potential, if you ask me.
Connor laughed, but made it look like a sneeze. Don't worry, he's around, Connor said. He wondered what Shakespeare would have thought about Red's endorsement. Alex was looking through all the other books in the library. Some of the titles that caught her eye were Royal Romances Through the Ages, History of the Age of Magic, Mammals of the Northern Kingdom, and The Extinction of Dragons. She knew she could easily spend a month in Froggy's library, reading everything in it.
Look at this one, Froggy said,
pulling a book from a high shelf. I think you two would appreciate it. He handed it to the twins, and they read the title together. It had a dark red cover and illustrations pasted on pages inside.
Myths, legends, and collecting spells, Alex read with surprise. Is it about the wishing spell?
That and many others, Froggy said. There are all kinds of gathering folklores in there. I had no idea there were so many, but who knows which ones are real and which are not.
They flipped through the pages, skimming past chapters about various legends of the fairy tale world. A few caught their eye as they searched. The Sorcerer's Sword was a weapon believed to have gone missing during the Dragon Age and allegedly could cut through anything. The Wand of Wonderment was a magic wand built from the most treasured items of the most hated people in the world and made whoever possessed it invincible. The Vanity Crown was made of the most valuable jewels in all the kingdoms and was rumored to transform whoever wore it into the most attractive person alive. They came across a section devoted to the wishing spell, and Alex read aloud as Connor followed.
The wishing spell is a legendary spell mostly told to children to inspire a work ethic that grants one wish to whoever collects a series of special objects.
Several people have died trying to test the theory of the wishing spell. But due to all that is unknown about the spell, it is highly unlikely that the spell exists, and is thought to be only a childish story.
If I had a nickel for every time we proved a childish story was true, Connor said under his breath.
There was a knock on the door, and the handmaiden poked her head inside the library.
A message from the Charming Kingdom has just arrived for you, Your Majesty, she said.
Oh? Red asked. Let's see it. The handmaiden walked in and handed Red the letter. It was in a white envelope that had a golden glass slipper wax seal on the back.
I wonder what this is all about, Red said as she opened it. I doubt Chance and Cinderella are throwing a ball at a time like this.
She read the letter and her eyes grew wide. She placed a hand over her mouth.
Oh my, she said. What is it, dear? Froggy asked. Pinocchio Prison has been attacked by the Enchantress, Red said, looking up from the envelope. The Charmings are hosting a meeting for the Happily Ever After Assembly.
Red handed him the envelope, and Froggy read with the twins looking over his shoulder. To Her Majesty Queen Red Riding Hood, we regretfully inform you that late yesterday evening, the Enchantress attacked Pinocchio Prison, consuming it with her enchanted plants. There's still no word of any survivors. Your presence is requested tomorrow evening at the Charming Palace, where a meeting will be held with all heads of state and the Happily Ever After Assembly to discuss the current situation. Your attendance will be expected unless other word is received. Sincerely, their Royal Majesties, King Chance and Queen Cinderella.
Red sighed and nodded her head. I'll have to leave at once, Red told the handmaiden. Please prepare a carriage for us to travel in and another carriage for my overnight luggage.
The handmaiden nodded and hurried out of the library with her instructions. Alex and Connor looked to each other, knowing they were thinking the same thing.
We have to go to this meeting, Froggy, Alex said. We have to know what's going on.
And why is that? Red asked.
The Enchantress has our mother, Connor said. We need to figure out a way to save her.
Well, what does your grandmother say? Red asked.
Alex and Connor looked at each other cautiously, wanting to break the news to Red gently. She doesn't even know we're here, Connor said.
She doesn't want us to know anything, Alex said.
Red cocked her head sideways and glared at Froggy.
Hold on a second, she said. Are you telling me the fairy godmother's runaway grandchildren are hiding in my castle?
Froggy turned a shade of light green.
Like I said, I couldn't leave them wandering alone in the forest, he said with an apologetic laugh.
Red turned the same color as her clothing.
Do you know how much trouble we could get into if the fairy council finds them here?
Red yelled. It doesn't matter, because no one is going to tell them where we are, Connor said sternly.
Excuse me, but who died and elected you my successor? Red said. I should have you both thrown out of here.
Connor raised an eyebrow and crossed his arms. But you won't, he said snidely, because you know what's worse than involuntarily housing the fairy godmother's runaway grandchildren? Voluntarily kicking out the fairy godmother's runaway grandchildren. Red made a couple high-pitched grunts as she looked between the twins and Froggy. She hated being compromised in her own home.
How are you going to get inside that meeting? Froggy asked the twins. It's for the heads of state only. It's very exclusive. Besides, your grandmother's going to be there. How would you hide from her?
Alex sighed, thinking of how they are going to pull it off.
We'll need to hide in something, she said. Something large enough to fit both of us inside it, but not suspicious looking.
Connor's eyes lit up, and he looked around the room, searching for something he had seen when they came in. He walked across the room and pulled a portrait of Red off the wall and brought it to her.
Hey, Red, Connor said. Do you still have this dress?
Alex and Froggy walked to Red's chair to take a look at what he was referring to. In the portrait, Red was wearing an enormous ball gown that protruded from her waist and flowed to the floor.
I believe so, actually, Red said. It was one of the only dresses that was saved in the fire. Wait a second. You're not thinking what I think you're thinking, are you?
Connor looked up at Froggy and his sister with a giant smirk on his face. It didn't take them long to figure out what he was planning, and once they did, matching grins appeared on their faces.
It's perfect, Alex said. I have to admit, it's very clever, Froggy said.
Red was appalled.
Have you all gone mad? Red said. You expect me to waltz into a meeting with the Happily Ever After Assembly with two brats under my dress? Absolutely not. I will not have any part in this whatsoever.
Alex and Connor looked to each other, and their grins disappeared. Each gestured for the other to do or say something to convince her.
Red, Alex said, leaning down by her side. Our mom is in danger. We need to know what's going on so we can figure out a way to save her.
Connor leaned down on Red's other side, taking his sister's lead.
She's all we have, Red,
Connor said. If anything happens to her, we'll be orphans. Red was accosted by their pleading faces. She knew that she couldn't say no to that. Even she wasn't that selfish.
All right, Red said. I'll help you out this one time, but after this, I'm done.
Large smiles appeared on the twins' faces. Red rubbed the sides of her head, wondering how on earth she had gotten so involved so easily. It had been such a quiet day until the twins showed up.
Thanks, Red, Alex said. You won't regret it, Connor added.
Red sank into her chair.
Can I get that in writing? She asked.
Chapter 12. A Not-So-Charming Evening. The twins left with Froggy and Red shortly after receiving the letter about the Happily Ever After assembly. The four of them rode in one carriage, while all of Red's necessary luggage was carried in a separate carriage behind them. The twins felt sorry for the horses pulling the second carriage. It seemed like a heavy heave. They had half a dozen soldiers surrounding them as they traveled, which Froggy insisted was the perfect amount for safety, but not enough to cause any unwanted attention. Halfway there, they came to a stop so Red could change into the enormous gown their scheme required. They pulled into a tiny field between two large oak trees, and Red transformed the first carriage into a dressing room. She kicked Connor and Froggy out and made Alex stay inside to help her dress. It was definitely a challenge, as the gown was much bigger than the inside of the carriage.
I'd just like to point out that Queen Snow White never has to change on the side of the road, Red said, struggling to pull the heavy dress over her head. I suppose that's what I get for being an elected queen. It must be some consolation to know you were wanted, Alex said, trying to help Red move through the dress. They actually chose you to lead their kingdom. It wasn't just handed to you. Not really, Red said. After the Kroll Revolution, it was between me and the third little pig. And he didn't even want the job. He was a total recluse. He barely came out of that brick house he was so proud of.
And with one last effort, Red pushed herself up through the center of the gown.
There we go, she said, out of breath.
The boys rejoined them inside the carriage, and the procession continued to the charming palace. There was physically no room for anything else inside the carriage, with the four bodies and the mound of endless red fabric crammed inside.
Oh, no,
Red said, after they had been on the move for less than 5 minutes. What is it? Connor asked, with his face pressed against the window.
Now I have to tinkle, Red peeped.
Everyone else in the carriage groaned. The following evening, Queen Red's party arrived at the Charming Palace. The twins couldn't resist ogling all the storybook estates and villages they passed on the way to the palace's front steps. Something seemed different about the Charming Kingdom, though the twins couldn't put their finger on it. Even beyond the lack of villagers parading through the streets and trading in the shops, there was a very gloomy vibe that floated through the whole kingdom. The carriages rolled up to the bottom of the lengthy staircase leading up to the palace's entrance, and the twins were relieved to finally be getting out of the compact carriage. They didn't care how crammed they would be under Red's dress. They were greeted by a palace footman. Froggy immediately jumped out of the carriage and busied him with unloading the luggage in the second carriage. The twins both hopped out of the carriage and crouched on the ground. Red was next to hop out and landed directly in the middle of them. Her gown exploded out of the carriage and securely covered the twins below her. It was perfect.
So far so good,
Alex whispered under Red's dress. Nice bloomers, Red, Connor said, chuckling about the knee-length undershorts she had strategically put on. Red grunted and kneed Alex in the head.
Ouch, that was me, Red,
Alex said.
Apologies,
Red said, and then kneed Connor in the head.
Ouch,
Connor yelled. Froggy walked back to find Red and the twins perfectly in position.
Are we ready for this? Froggy asked.
I think so, Alex said. Roger, roger, Connor said.
That's reassuring,
Froggy said, and used a handkerchief to wipe the beads of sweat on his forehead.
Because I most certainly am not.
Take a chill pill, Frog, Connor said. No one is going to know we're under here. The footman glanced over suspiciously from the second carriage, positive he had just heard voices come from bodies that weren't visible.
Make sure you two stay as silent as possible under there, Froggy said, and gulped so hard he croaked. Let's make our way into the palace, shall we?
Red took a step forward the twins weren't ready for.
Red, we can't see anything. You're going to have to guide us,
Connor whispered up at her.
And how am I supposed to do that?
Red whispered down at him.
Narrate what you're doing,
Alex said. Red closed her eyes and took a deep breath, mentally preparing herself for the evening she was in for.
Fine, I'm walking toward the stairs,
Red informed them, and they moved with her. She was walking too fast for them to keep up.
Take baby steps, Connor whispered. We're crouched down here like chimpanzees.
Red's nostrils flared.
Sure, she said sharply. Now I'm walking slowly up the stairs.
The first few steps were a disaster. Froggy kept gasping every time he saw one of their sneakers peeking out from under the gown. Slowly but surely, they managed to get the hang of it, and smoothly made their way up the enormous flight of steps. Back at the carriages, the footman could have sworn he saw three pairs of feet under Red's dress out of the corner of his eye. But when he double-checked, they were gone. The footman continued unloading the second carriage, deciding he just needed glasses. Or to retire. Alex's and Connor's backs were starting to ache from crawling up the steps like monkeys, but it only got worse when they reached the top of the stairs and the ground became flat, causing them to slouch even more.
And now I'm walking toward the palace entrance. No more steps, Red said out loud.
A few of the Charming Kingdom guards patrolling the entrance looked at her funny. After all, she was walking at a snail's pace and talking to herself.
You certainly are,
Froggy said to Red, and patted her back, trying to reduce the awkwardness.
Prince Charlie, welcome back, sir,
the twins heard a familiar voice say.
Sir Lambton,
Froggy clarified for them.
Good to see you, although I wish the visit were for a different occasion.
Alex and Connor tensed up, knowing Sir Lambton was just a few feet away from them. They held their breath, afraid he'd hear even that.
Now I'm walking inside the charming palace, Red said to the twins,
but was caught by Sir Lambton.
And I can't believe it. It feels like I was home just a minute ago. Such a quick trip.
It was a decent cover, but from under the gown, the twins could feel the suspicious gaze Lambton was giving Red.
Are you feeling all right, Your Majesty?
Lambton asked her.
You're walking so slowly. Are you ill?
Alex and Connor exchanged a glance, wondering how Red was going to cover up this one.
Perfectly fine, Sir Lambton, Red said. I just selected the wrong pair of shoes to travel in. My feet are killing me.
Alex and Connor sighed with relief. Connor gave Red a thank you pat on her knee. She quickly slapped his head through the gown, and Connor bit his fist to silence a scream.
Just an itch, Red said with a tight smile.
How are things here?
Froggy asked, trying to distract Lambton.
Terrible, he said. Have you not heard?
I'm guessing not. Froggy said.
What happened?
Lambton let out the most troubled sigh the twins had ever heard.
Princess Hope was kidnapped last night.
The twins gasped, unable to contain their shock, but it was covered by the gasps coming from Red and Froggy.
What?
Froggy said, devastated by the news about his only niece.
What do you mean kidnapped? By whom?
Rumpelstiltskin, Sir Lambton said. It looks like he's working for the Enchantress again, only this time he succeeded.
It grew quiet. The whole world seemed to be falling apart. For everyone. A few moments later, after traveling across the red-carpeted interior of the Charming Palace's entrance hall, the twins knew they had arrived inside the ballroom, recognizing the golden dance floor beneath them. The room was filled with troubled voices and impatient footsteps milling about.
"Here, Your Majesty, please have a seat,"
the twins heard Sir Lambton say.
"Thank you," Red said. Now I'm going to slowly sit on the stool I've so graciously been provided with.
The twins cringed from the inelegance of Red's statement. But thankfully, everyone else in the room was too occupied to have even noticed Red and Froggy enter the room. She slowly sat on the stool placed behind her, giving the twins enough time to adjust themselves to her seated position, sitting on the floor beside her. It was a relief to all their joints. The twins could hear small conversations from all corners of the room. They wished they could put faces to the voices they heard. Connor nudged Alex and quietly gestured to a loose seam he'd found in Red's dress. He carefully pulled the seam apart even more and created a small hole to peek out of. Alex did the same on her side, and they were finally able to see outside the gown. Although they knew everyone in the room, there was so much heartache and hopelessness worn on all the faces, the kings and queens were almost unrecognizable. It was hard for the twins to see them all like this. Their lives had always been perfect examples of happiness, but here they were now, the most distraught group of people they'd ever seen. Queen Cinderella was seated on her throne, devastated beyond belief. Her hands covered her swollen eyes as tears rolled down her face. She was comforted by Queen Snow White and Queen Rapunzel, who used the tip of her remarkably long braid to dry Cinderella's tears. The men paced around the corner of the ballroom. King Chance never stopped moving, furious that his daughter had been taken from him. King Chandler and Rapunzel's husband stood near him, unable to do anything but watch. Froggy joined them, lending his support with his presence.
Last night, I heard her crying, Cinderella told the women at her throne. I got out of bed and went to her room. A few of the maids were on their way inside, but